Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Your co-host and producer of Crime Beat, this hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night. And it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artists First World Radio Network. Tonight we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron's an award-winning author based in South Carolina. He's the author of 29 books, including Sergeant Smack, The Lives and Times of Ike Atkinson, Kingpin and His Band of Brothers, and the just-published Straight from the Hood, Amazing but True Gangster Tales. He's also the producer of two award-winning documentaries. Get out there and buy these books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed. Ron is also a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland documentary series and publisher of Strategic Media Books. You could go to www.strategicmediabooks.com. Be sure to visit his website also at www.ronchepsik.com. I'll spell you his last name. It's C-H-E-P-E-S-I-U-K. You can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio of my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, which is also my hometown, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in international shipping business, where he is a contributing writer to several trade publications. This year, he'll be publishing a book titled Movers and Mavericks, an anthology, and also another book about the Ganelda shipwreck that sank 300 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. Great promo as usual. Thank you again. Well, thanks again. Tonight, we have a very special featured guest, James W. Douglas, author of the best-selling book titled JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. In his well-researched but disturbing best-selling narrative, Douglas, a noted peace activist and co-founder of the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action in Washington State, argues that the JFK assassination was the result of sinister conspiracy involving a coup d'etat at the highest levels of the U.S. government. It's going to be a great show, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Well, Ronnie, just before we reach into our mailbag, buddy, you know, it's our 41st show tonight,
wow.
and how time flies. We're running out of space to put a notch on our sidearms there, buddy.
Yeah, and the guests just get more interesting, and the subjects, you know, crime is such a wide-ranging subject that we have a lot of fun in terms of choosing subjects for featured guests, and I think we're kind of lucky because I don't think we had one guest that bombed.
That's for sure. You know, we're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and thumbs up, but a couple of comments that weren't that thumbs up, but we'll take the good with the bad.
That was from your mother. She said, eat your peas.
Well,
eat your peas.
That's right, for sure. I'd like to thank all our production people at Artists First World Radio Network as well, in particular Scott, Corey, and Tony for making this show possible. Like I said, Ron, internet radio is a place to be. It's great to be recognized, and it proves we're right on track. Now, here's this week's mailbag. Ronnie, this one is from Abraham Pinault of Brussels, Belgium, who writes, I enjoyed your show with David Gibb last week. His description of Colonel Russell Williams was a fascinating account of a twisted individual who rose to the ranks and fooled everybody. Just goes to show you these kind of guys can fall through the cracks. Great show. Keep up the good work. Any comments on that, Ronnie?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the most chilling interviews I've ever experienced because this guy was completely normal. There were no signs growing up or anything, and he turned out to be one of the most famous killers in Canadian history, Russell Williams, and he was in the military. I mean, my God, this guy flew flew Queen Elizabeth, Prime Minister of Canada, and a lot of other famous dignitaries. And meanwhile, he was a psychopath. So it was really fascinating, and I think we really can't tell what evil lurks in the hearts of man, right?
That's for sure. It was a fascinating interview with Mr. Gipp. Well, this one is from Ken Ryan of Newfoundland, Canada. It's a Canadian show tonight. He writes, "The Canadian military hierarchy must be looking really hard at the top brass now. What a colossal embarrassment. Hopefully the military psychologists will get their act together and develop safeguards in weeding out these nutcases." Anything to add to that, Ronnie?
Well, I don't think you could brand the entire military because of Russell Williams. You're always going to have bad apples. And I think that most people are very normal, and that he was an aberration. And so I don't think we should brand the Canadian military. But they do have to look at some of their protocols, because this guy rolls very high. And as our guest David Gibbs said, they're reevaluating, how they examine recruits and how they deal with them.
Well, this guy was touted to be a top soldier eventually, and he went down the drain, unfortunately. But that's the way it goes over crime.
Right. Fortunately, he only murdered two women.
Yeah.
They caught him in time.
It's a terrible, terrible story. Right. And also, Ronnie, I'd like to add that David Gibbs' book titled "Camouflage Killer" has been sold and it's in production on a movie that's expected to be released next year. The rights to the film were bought by Richard Lowry Productions of Montreal, and it's expected to be a North American production with possible world distribution. David's book has also been published in Ireland by the UK publisher Y Books under the title Evil in Plain Sight. We wish David much success.
Right.
Well,
congratulations.
Ronnie, absolutely. Well, Ronnie, you want to give our listeners out there in that wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show and tell us what you're up to in the publishing world.
Right. Next week we have Rick Perrello, who's going to talk about his book, To Kill an Irishman, which is the base of a movie that's being released this year called Kill an Irishman, which has a number of stars in it. And he's going to talk about crime, organized crime in Cleveland. And it's a very interesting book. It was like the terrorism capital of the United States in the 1970s with car bombs. It looked like Northern Ireland, in fact. So it's going to be an interesting discussion. Two of our books for Strategic Media Books, Straight from the Hood and Chili Pimmin in Atlantic City, were chosen one of the 75 best books of 2011 by Conversations Book Club. So I'd like to thank two of our authors, Scott Wilson and Mickman Gordine, who authored those two books. Congratulations and job well done.
Well, Ronnie, congratulations to you. You keep on piling up those awards. As I said before, you're going to need a warehouse to store them all in. And good for you, and good luck to you. Well, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never, never stops. It never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Here is this week's rap sheet item number one. Dateline, November 9th, 2011. New York City former narcotics detective admits drug planting common. Hey, Ronnie, this guy named Steven Anderson, a former New York cop, a narcotics detective, recently testified that he regularly saw police plant drugs on innocent people as a way for officers to meet arrest quotas. While the news may shock many civilians, the custom is so well known among officers that it has a name. It's called flaking. This practice is reportedly costing the city over $1 million. Hey, Ronnie, what's up with this police racket?
Wow, it's just amazing. And quotas, they have arrest quotas. I mean, that's amazing. So you got to arrest a certain number of people, whether they're innocent or guilty. The thing about this that's really amazing, I did a little research, is that there's no database which tracks this. To see the number of cases dismissed because of this kind of illegal behavior. But, people really get affected. You can't get a job, because you're a felon in this tight economy. You can't travel, outside of the country, and you lose your voting rights. You're difficult to get affordable housing, all because of crooked cops. And it's just another example of the corruption in this society, whether it's Wall Street, law enforcement, or the politicians in Washington.
Yeah, well, it's a flagrant disregard for citizens' rights. Something's got to be done about this really quick. Now, rap sheet item number two. Dateline, November 11th, 2011. Mexico City Mexican drug gangs targeting internet users. Hey, Ronnie, Mexico's hyper-violent Zetas drug cartel appears to be launching what may be one of the first campaigns by an organized crime group to silence commentary on the internet. The cartel has already attacked rivals, journalists, and other perceived enemies. Now the target is an online chat room called Nuevo Laredo on Vivo. That allows users to comment on the activities of the Zetas and others in the city on the border of Texas. This is a new tactic, Ron, of the deadly Mexican drug cartels. You know, they'll stop at nothing to get their point across, What do you figure?
Well, this is quite unusual for criminals, you know, but it's the new media. And traditionally, I did a lot of work in Colombia. You know, I wrote 2 books on the Colombian drug trade, and they routinely targeted journalists. But what's amazing is that they're so sophisticated that they could actually track down these people on Facebook because they're supposed to be anonymous. But it's just one example. We could have chose the story about the helicopter crashing, the number 2 point man in the war on drugs in Mexico getting killed. There's some suspicion there. They're recruiting little kids, you know, to join the drug gangs. So it's spiraling out of control in Mexico, and really not a lot of attention is being paid. And again, as we discussed on the show with previous guests, we got to change the drug laws in this country.
Absolutely, you got that right on, man. Now, Ronnie. Just before we continue with our show, just a quick comment on Whitey Bulger. It's been reported that famous mafia boss Robert DeLuca is cooperating with the FBI. He'll be testifying against Bulger. Hey, the oath of silence, Omerta, is going the way of the dodo bird for these guys. They're all singing like canaries.
Right. I thought immediately of our guest, Dick Lair, who did such a great job giving background on Whitey Bulger and the significance on that. But this guy actually had his finger in 1989. He took blood from his middle finger, you know, promising never to snitch on his fellow gangsters. And he's just one of a series of godfathers, Joe Messina, Ruff, Natalie in Philadelphia. And, you know, I don't understand the motivation for this guy. He served 34 months in jail after Bulger disappeared in 95. So there's really no charges against him as far as I could determine. And he and his wife all disappeared. The house is sold. They're gone from their Boston neighborhood. So it's going to be very interesting following this. And, of course, we're going to have another guest or two on because this trial is not going to be on, as Dick Lair said, probably for another year.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. We'll keep an eye on this one. Now, just before we get on with our very special guest, Mr. James W. Douglas, author of JFK and the Unspeakable, we'll take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have a question for our guest, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you and try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, tonight's very, very special guest is Mr. James W. Douglas, author of the best-selling book titled JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. Mr. Douglas takes the reader into the Oval Office during the tense days of the Cuban Missile Crisis, along the strange journey of Lee Harvey Oswald and his shadowy handlers, and to the winding streets of Dallas, where an ambush awaited John Kennedy's motorcade. James Douglas vividly, documents every imaginable step of the way of this horrendous crime of the century. Oliver Stone, director of the 1991 classic movie titled JFK, said James Douglas's book is the best account he's read on the tragedy and its significance. James Douglas' investigation begs the question, what role the U.S. government played in this assassination of the 35th President of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy? It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Jim Douglas.
Thank you very much.
I'm not going to call you James W.
Please call me Jim.
On that then. And I really appreciate you having you on the show. Willie and I were talking before we got on the air about what a great book it is. You know, I'm an academic, and it's really amazing to read such a good book with a lot of footnotes. it was really interesting on that. You got an unusual background. You're a peace activist, but you're writing about history, political history. And I was wondering how you got interested in the subject, because it took you 12 years, I understand, to complete. So that's a long time. It goes back before 9/11.
Well, it goes back a lot farther than that. It goes back to the assassination of Dr. King, and I was a professor of religion at the University of Hawaii, and when he was assassinated, and the students that I was working with in a course on the theology of peace, they decided to respond to his martyrdom by taking a commitment against the Vietnam War. They wound up going to prison for times ranging from 6 months to 2 years for the resistance to the Vietnam War. And I went to prison with them for periods shorter than that for sitting in front of troop convoys and things of that sort. So Martin Luther King's assassination changed my life. And as I investigated that over the years, and even attended a trial for it in Memphis in 1999, I kept thinking, well, what about JFK? And also, what about Malcolm X? And what about Robert Kennedy? Mm. So I've been working on all four for the last 15 years. And the first, chronologically, is JFK, and that's why he's the first one done.
Right, so you're going to do four books on each of...
Well, Martin and Malcolm complement each other, I've discovered, and in the way that they were executed, which is the proper term for it, complement each other, so probably they will be in the same book. And I also just finished writing a book on the assassination of Mohandas Gandhi called Gandhi and the Unspeakable. Well, that was a sort of a detour that I didn't expect, but I got hugely involved
right.
in Gandhi's death, and so that one will be published next
right.
February.
We're getting ahead of ourselves, but the 60s were a decade of assassinations. You mentioned Malcolm, you mentioned Dr. King.
Yes.
And Robert Kennedy. Are these related? Is this part of a bigger conspiracy in your mind, or are you still open?
It's after 15 years of research, the way I would describe it is, it's the same story repeated one, two, three times after JFK.
Mm.
It's the same story. It's different dimensions of the same story. In 4.5 years, two people who were either president or a president-to-be, as Robert Kennedy was turning toward the presidency, and 15 minutes after he won the crucial Democratic primary in California, he was assassinated. Those were the two at the top of the pyramid, and then the two at the edges toward the bottom in terms of the social strategy and the contours of mm-hmm. those assassinations were Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. And they have the same basic characteristics, all four of them do.
Right. Well, your thesis is unspeakable because it involves a really unbelievably sinister conspiracy. Can you lay out for our listeners just briefly what is the thesis of your book, and then we could get into particular parts of it.
Well, it's the story basically of a man who was the most powerful individual on earth, who was a cold warrior, and who yet, in the course of his presidency, John F. Kennedy, had the courage, under enormous pressure, almost inconceivable pressure, to turn in a direction that stood for the survival of humanity. And it was a process that was beginning when he was alarmed by the Bay of Pigs. It went through the Cuban Missile Crisis when he became far more profoundly disturbed by what was going on in his government, and then he made a series of very critical turns in the direction of peace that took him right straight to Dallas as a consequence of that. And it's a very profound story of one could call it turning, shuva in the Hebrew scriptures, metanoia in the Christian scriptures, repentance, conversion. These are all kinds of religious or moral terms, but they describe what happened to Kennedy as a result of his seeing that if he didn't turn, and if the United States government didn't turn, the human race would be destroyed. And that's as true today as it was in 1963.
Right. You know, a lot of people still look upon Kennedy as a Cold War warrior. You know, I remember
right.
people talking, you know, when I was going to school in the late 60s, saying, you know, well, if Kennedy was alive, and, you know, it would be different. And other people say, no, you know, he would have carried on the same St. Pauli. What did you use for research to show that Kennedy had this, was going through this transformation?
Well, the most basic sources are the Foreign Relations of the United States, which is the official Department of State history. By the way, I live next to the railroad track. You can hear the train. I'm in Birmingham, Alabama, next to the track.
Don't jump on one of those trains, please. Finish the interview first.
Good. Well, what assassinated John F. Kennedy was a much bigger and more powerful train than anything going past my house. So, but to take it, let's see, I've lost your question. I was thinking about trains going over all of us here.
I was talking about your research.
Because
a lot of people think Kennedy
this
was...
Is, this, these are all the official documents of the John F. Kennedy assassination and of the State Department and of the Defense Department. They have all been published in Foreign Relations of the United States, and those which were classified because of the JFK Records Act that was passed in 92, they have to now be declassified, as hundreds of thousands of documents have been. So I was drawing on an enormous number of documents, as well as a lot of personal interviews.
When you were researching a book, did you start off with that thesis, that there was a coup d'etat, or did your research uncover the thesis? As you went through the records, you started to see a pattern which led to a sinister conspiracy involving the military-industrial complex.
I had already uncovered a lot of information about Martin Luther King's assassination, and I attended a trial where that was the conclusion of the trial, which is the subject perhaps of another program you can do someday, a trial that has been practically ignored by everybody. And so having learned that Martin Luther King was assassinated by the United States government, as given in a verdict in a trial in 1999 in Memphis, my hypothesis was, well, what about the President of the United States? Wouldn't it be even more likely if something significant were done by him, even in any way analogous to King, that the same thing could have happened to him? But I did not know until I went through an enormous number of documents and sources whether or not that hypothesis held true. It not only held true, the evidence of the conspiracy from high levels was enormous. And I cannot give you a conclusion as to who pulled which trigger, but I can give you, as I tried to in the book, an enormous amount of evidence of what Kennedy himself was doing, the courage that he had to do that, and what his own government was doing in response to him. That's all over the place.
Right. Which is very interesting, because you talk about back channel negotiations with Khrushchev and Castro, which is really quite amazing.
Yeah.
Discuss this how this came about and what it did to the, I'm going to use the term military industrial complex. And you may want to define that for our audience. There's probably a lot of young people there that, it was a popular term back in the 60s and maybe early 70s, but
it was a term that came as you know from President Eisenhower in his last address, his final address as president, just days before Kennedy was inaugurated. And Eisenhower warned that the power that had been taken on by a combination of forces in the military and in profit-making corporations was endangering democracy in the United States. And it was a warning that Eisenhower made after he had basically succumbed to that power to a large degree during his presidency. Mm-hmm. And he left it up to Kennedy to deal with it. So Kennedy then did try to deal with it in those decisions that began with the Bay of Pigs.
Right.
And the Bay of Pigs is a situation in which he felt he had been betrayed by the Central Intelligence Agency. He had been lied to, he had been manipulated, and he had been put into a situation where the CIA counted on him having to send in U.S. troops in order to win in a context where he could not do so without a full-scale invasion of Cuba. And he was so furious after having undergone that experience that he said very precisely, I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds, as reported by the New York Times in an investigative article after his death.
And, of course, the stakes were raised when we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, right?
They were raised enormously. And that's, you were asking about his relationship to Nikita Khrushchev.
Right.
That's crucial to all of this because he and Khrushchev met only one time in Vienna in early in his presidency, but they realized in the course of that experience that they had to begin to dialogue behind the scenes because they couldn't do so with hundreds of cameras focused on them and every sentence being recorded. And Kennedy suggested that quietly to Khrushchev, and Khrushchev sent him his first secret letter in the fall of 1961, and it was smuggled, literally smuggled, into Kennedy's office through you know, a newspaper that was given to Pierre Salinger, and Pierre Salinger handed it in to Kennedy.
Right.
And that was the initiating of their correspondence, in which Khrushchev suggested to Kennedy that he used the atheist, the communist Khrushchev, used the biblical symbol of Noah's Ark, and he said that the two of them were on this ark and they were in a sea basically of nuclear weapons, and it was up to us, Mr. President, to keep that ark afloat.
Right.
And that correspondence continued for the rest of Kennedy's presidency until it was cut off without his knowledge by his never receiving Khrushchev's last letter two months before his death.
Right. The Russian archives have opened, you know, since the fall of the Soviet Union.
Yes.
Is there new information? Did you make use of that information or have access to it?
Oh, absolutely. I was referring to the secret correspondence. That all came, incidentally, by a Freedom of Information Act request from a newspaper in Canada that opened up that correspondence in the late 80s, and it's now officially published, although there may be other letters that will emerge eventually. And then all these hundreds of thousands of documents that have been declassified as a result of Oliver Stone's movie, the pressure that exerted on the Congress and the JFK Records Act, that's what I was drawing on that was not available until recent years.
Right.
And it presents a very complete picture of the Kennedy presidency and his conflicts step by step with the CIA, with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, with even his key advisors that were closest to him in the White House.
Right.
Well, yeah, I've got
before you go on, Willie, I just want to follow this up here with
sure.
You obviously reject the Warren Commission, you know, findings, and maybe you can explain, you know, what's wrong with the Warren Commission, then we could talk about Oswald, who plays a very central role in your thesis.
Well, what's wrong with the Warren Commission? Well, let's begin with who's on it.
Alan Dulles, right?
It's the Fox investigating the murder in the hen house. That's
right.
Alan Dulles.
Right.
Alan Dulles was the primary focus of Kennedy's comment, "I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds." He fired Alan Dulles as a result of the deception in the Bay of Pigs, and he fired Alan Dulles's main subordinates who were involved in that, one of whom was the brother to the man who would then be the mayor of Dallas when John F. Kennedy is assassinated. But to appoint Alan Dulles to the Warren Commission is appointing a man who should have been regarded as one of the primary suspects in the case. Alan Dulles and the CIA had been involved in assassinations around the world, covert assassinations.
Right.
And then Kennedy fires him, and this man turns up as the most active participant of the Warren Commission, which should actually have been called the Dulles Commission.
The Dulles Commission. Well, that's very interesting. So is this part of a Sinner conspiracy in itself? Because you point out in your book that the CIA planted people in government, right? They had spies everywhere.
That was the process that undermined all kinds of Kennedy actions, because he would give orders and they wouldn't be carried out because people in key positions were actually CIA agents that had been appointed to those positions.
Right. Let's take a break, Willie, and we'll come back with your question right after the break.
You bet. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Harib. Now back to Ron and Mr. James W. Douglas, author of JFK and the and the unspeakable, why he died and why it matters. Now, I just got a quick question. We were talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and Bobby Kennedy, as everybody knows, played a very integral role in that very alarming situation. I remember when I was a 14-year-old kid, we were hiding under the desks in school doing these drills. Anyway, would you characterize Bobby as the rudder in this whole thing, keeping Kennedy on even keel on this whole situation and providing the embargo, which sort of put things at ease a bit? Any comments on that?
had JFK not appointed his brother Attorney General, he would have been almost totally isolated. And Robert Kennedy was his intermediary with the Soviet ambassador in Washington at the most critical moment of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he was sent by JFK to the ambassador with a message to Khrushchev to that JFK needed his help. This is regarding his primary adversary in the Cold War, his biggest enemy in terms of the policies of his government, and especially the CIA and the Joint Chiefs. Mm-hmm. He was asking his enemy for help, and that all came with the support of his brother and the knowledge of very, very few other people other than his brother. And when that message was received in Moscow by Khrushchev turned to his foreign minister and said, "We have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him." That's when everything turned upside down in the Cold War. And Robert Kennedy describes that whole series of events in his own memoir, 13 Days. It was not published until after his assassination. It was simply his notes that he was writing during that whole process.
We were talking about the Warren Commission, and of course they concluded that Oswald alone acted in the assassination of JFK. And
but they didn't tell us much about who Oswald really was.
Right. That's right. And he plays a central part. He essentially, the way you describe it, a patsy of the CIA. And that's kind of intriguing for me because Oswald to me seems such a loser. And I was wondering why would the CIA, take their chances in planning this elaborate assassination, which is going to change the course of Western history with a guy like Oswald.
Well, Oswald was a loser in every respect, but he was also working for the CIA for years, and what the Warren Commission did not tell us was that Oswald, while he was a Marine, was at Atsugi Air Force Base, the biggest CIA base in the Far East, out of which the U-2 spy plane was moving periodically over the Soviet Union. Mm. And the radar operator, a key radar operator in that process, mm-hmm. with a high security clearance, was Lee Harvey Oswald. So that Oswald, from that point on, was working with the CIA. And so when he is a so-called defector to the Soviet Union after his very strange discharge later, he is a person who then says to the Soviet Union, this is on record even by the Warren Commission, he says to the Soviet Union that he wants to give them special information that he has as a result of his being in the Marine Corps.
Right.
Well, the Warren Commission doesn't tell us anything about the fact that he had been working on the U-2 and was had a top clearance for U-2 information. If we put all of this together with the downing of the U-2 at the time of the Paris conference between President Eisenhower and Nikita Khrushchev, one could even conclude that the information that Oswald would have passed over to the Soviet Union could have resulted in the destruction of that conference because of the downing of the U-2 spy plane. So for Oswald then to be welcomed back to the United States, as we know he was, as soon as he said, I think I'll go back after being over here for a couple of years working in a Soviet factory and saying that I'm going to give over these secrets from the Marine Corps, I mean, this makes absolutely no sense whatever unless Oswald is something other than a defector.
Right. Well, you describe how he was moved stage by stage to
step
Dallas.
Step by step.
Right, step by step. So what happened at Dealey Plaza? I mean, was Oswald the principal shooter? How do you describe what happened?
The key to Dealey Plaza is the total withdrawal of security from President Kennedy. The Secret Service, the motorcycle police, the Dallas Sheriff's Office, all of them withdraw their security from Dealey Plaza, which is like a canyon of high buildings. It's got sewer openings. It's a total trap that Kennedy is driven into, and he has to take a very slow turn in an automobile that is driving approximately 40 miles slower than the lowest limit allowed by the Secret Service in its own manuals. The whole thing is a setup. And so Oswald, who's having lunch on the second floor, as seen by a witness just minutes before Kennedy drives into the into Dealey Plaza, he is not the assassin. In fact, in terms of the medical evidence, it couldn't have been anything other than multiple shots coming from various locations, and certainly the least significant of which would have been the sixth floor, which was impossible for Oswald to be on. He was down eating lunch in the second floor.
Right. Well, JFK was fatalistic about his life in the last months. You know,
yes.
He spoke often, as you point out in your book. You know, he spoke often about death. And
did he
have a? I mean, what really is amazing is that there's this convertible, right? And if he was, you know, suspicious of these people, I was wondering if that was part of the plot, too.
I'm not sure I understood the question.
Well, I meant the convertible he was driving in.
Oh, the convertible?
Yeah, right, the convertible, because, you know, I mean...
Well, that was flown immediately back to Washington and wound up in Detroit within a few days and was totally rebuilt. What we're talking about is primary evidence in the assassination being destroyed within hours. Actually, the convertible, we can see it being washed down just outside Parkland Hospital, while Kennedy's already dead, but they're trying to do what they can to save the man in the hospital, and the convertible, the evidence is already being destroyed by the Secret Service just outside the hospital.
Right.
All of this is on record. So the total destruction of basic evidence in this crime of the century is the main evidence against the government. They're destroying evidence left, right, and center, including the convertible.
Right, you say right, left, and center, including the convertible. What other evidence, major evidence that helped?
His brain. They lost his brain. They lost his brain. This is on record that the brain of John F. Kennedy, which of course is the primary evidence because it's the it shows how the shots came in and so forth, and it also shows in terms of the other evidence that we have how they were destroying his brain before they even got it to the autopsy. That brain has been lost. Nobody knows where it is. Well, it's wherever it is the destruction of basic evidence.
Right.
And now we have this thing coming out just the last few days about, oh, here's the
Air Force,
recording, the recording of the of all the communications on Air Force One. Mm-hmm. Well, there are 4.5 hours of communications that were on Air Force One, and now we're supposed to think that it's a great thing that we're going to be given 2 hours. Well, 2 hours of this. Well, that leaves 2.5 hours. Is that significant or not?
Right.
It is significant because even in the early days after the assassination, Theodore White, in his book, The Making of the President, told us what was on that in terms of the people who were in the presidential party. They said that they learned on that plane, you know, this is just an hour and a half or 2 hours after the assassination, they learned, oh, there was just one person responsible for all of this.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Lee Harvey Oswald, and there was no conspiracy.
Right.
This is an official statement being given by the Situation Room in the White House and delivered to both the Air Force One and to a second Air Force plane, the cabinet plane that Pierre Salinger and a bunch of the cabinet members are on their way to Tokyo.
Right.
And so all of these people are being told before Oswald has even been charged that there's no conspiracy. what is going on here?
Right. Well, I got a quick one.
Sure. I was going to say, when you talk of the conspiracy, you mentioned Alan Dulles, who served on the Warren Committee. Who are some of the other players, and have they ever talked, you know, like deathbed confessions, rambling, you know, confession of deathbed?
Yes. The chief players were very high up, and people like Richard Helms and James Jesus Angleton and David Atlee Phillips, who are all key to the assassination, you're not going to get too much from them except through documents that incriminate them without their, without their saying much of anything, although there are all kinds of angles that you can do circumstantially.
Mm.
But E. Howard Hunt, to his son, did give a confession, and he implicated the people that I've just mentioned,
right.
Angleton, Phillips, a guy named David Morales, who was the head of the CIA station in Miami. These are all very high-level and key CIA players, and E. Howard Hunt, when he confessed to his son shortly before his death, he mentioned all of these people as key to the assassination.
Right. Yeah. Willie?
Yeah. Okay,
he also mentioned a man, by the way, named Lyndon Johnson.
Oh,
yeah,
right,
well,
right.
That's the item of my question, curiously enough, Jim. As everybody knows, Lyndon Johnson and John F. Kennedy never, they always were at odds.
Yes.
And they certainly didn't see eye to eye on a lot of things. Do you think, in your wildest imagination, that Lyndon Johnson knew something about this conspiracy, knew that this would happen at this particular time? Any comments?
I didn't say that because I can't prove it, and I would not put in the book anything that I couldn't, to my own satisfaction, could prove and give it an end note and a source note to. I believe that Lyndon Johnson did have pre-knowledge of the assassination, and there are witnesses that have said that he did, but I couldn't corroborate them in a way that I felt was... was satisfactory. So I didn't put that in the book. There is a new book by a man named Philip Nelson, which goes farther than I tried to go on that road, and that heavily suggests that Lyndon Johnson was, in fact, a mastermind behind the assassination. I wouldn't go that far, but
wow.
A woman that I did speak with was Lyndon Johnson's mistress, and I'm convinced that that is true, one woman named Madeline Brown, and she said repeatedly, and I thought she was a credible witness, and I talked to her a number of times, and was going to meet with her in Dallas, but I couldn't because of a medical experience that I had. She said repeatedly that he told her the night before that he wasn't going to have to deal anymore with those damn Kennedys, be embarrassed by them anymore.
Right.
That was at the very night of before the assassination.
Right. Let's take a brief station break and go into the last part of our program. We could spend several hours talking about this fascinating subject with Jim Douglas. Go ahead, Willie.
You bet. It's such a fascinating subject, like you said, and great guest in Jim Douglas. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist's First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Harib. Now back to Ron and Mr. James W. Douglas, author of JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters.
Great. And it's a great book, great read. I really enjoy it, as did Willie. And any tips on buying the book? It must be all over the place.
You can get it anywhere you want.
Right. On that,
all you have to know is the name, JFK and the Unspeakable.
Right.
But let me mention one thing, and that is the four critical events in Kennedy's final year after the Cuban Missile Crisis that really damned him in terms of his national security state were his, number one, his American University address,
right.
June 10, 1963, in which he basically called for an end to the Cold War. Secondly, his negotiating within 6 weeks of that address, his partial nuclear test ban treaty with Nikita Khrushchev, an incredible turnaround by the two of them working together in Moscow, of all places.
Right.
Thirdly, his initiating a secret dialogue with Fidel Castro, which was actually transpiring on the afternoon he was assassinated. He had an unofficial representative meeting with Fidel Castro at that moment. And finally, his signing National Security Action Memorandum 263 to formally withdraw from Vietnam. He did that in October 1963, the month before he was assassinated. Each of those was more than was tolerable by his national security state.
Right. You were talking about LBJ, and you said the lack of evidence, so you know, you really didn't explore that. What about organized crime? You know, that a lot of people believe that organized crime in relationship with the CIA, talk about Santo Traficante, Giacana, and, you know, the group. What role did you find that they played in the conspiracy to kill JFK?
The CIA and organized crime are the same deal. when it comes to the CIA is the biggest organized crime in the United States government, alongside the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But certainly, organized crime was involved in deploying shooters, and just as when the CIA was planning to assassinate Castro, as they did for decades. Organized crime was always being deployed by the CIA as shooters, but it wasn't like organized crime ever gave orders to the CIA.
Right.
The CIA called the shots, and organized crime carried out the shots, and that's what happened in Dealey Plaza.
Right, and the Bay of Pigs invasion was implanted by the CIA to take control of the island to reopen the casinos, right?
Absolutely.
That was one of the objectives of that.
Yeah, so organized crime is part of the payroll for the CIA.
Right. So one of the saddest chapters in American history, we had JFK getting assassinated. What do you think would have happened if JFK would have lived and somehow survived this sinister coup?
I think he would have been killed 2 or 3 weeks after that. And if he had survived that one, I think he would have been killed 2 or 3 weeks after that.
So it was inevitable.
They were out to get JFK, and as you know from looking at the book, they tried to assassinate him on November 2, '63 in Chicago.
Right.
Exactly the same kind of plot. So if you look at Dallas through the eyes of the Chicago plot, you recognize they were out to get this man. They failed in Chicago. They did exactly the same plot in Dallas, and they succeeded in Dallas. They failed in Dallas, they would have done it in Washington or Los Angeles.
Right. So it was inevitable, then, you're saying, unfortunately.
I'm saying that he was target number one, and this plot was in process for months, if not years. I mean, from the point at the Bay of Pigs where he turned against the CIA, they had a bullseye on Kennedy, but it wasn't until the Cuban Missile Crisis when he again refused to attack Cuba, that it became decisive. I believe that's the decisive moment when he basically says to Khrushchev, "I'm going to work with you rather than with the CIA and the Joint Chiefs of Staff."
Did you ever think about maybe somebody out there is listening that's still alive?
I hope they're saying
Jim Douglas is getting too loud and his argument is too persuasive.
Well, you know. The worst thing is if nobody's listening. you know that. For 40 years as a peace and justice activist, I've been trying to get in the way of this train. You know, we're talking about trains because trains go outside my window here.
Right.
And if I can't in some small way get in front of that train that's going to destroy humanity, I'm not being a responsible citizen of this world.
We got a couple of minutes left. I got a couple of questions. Have there been any assassinations since relating to the military industrial complex?
I mentioned three.
I meant King Malcolm X, but I'm talking about subsequently. Back in say the 80s, 90s, have there been any assassinations that you could trace back to this cabal?
Well, they go on constantly. Every time a drone plane takes off from a United States Air Force base or a CIA base and goes over Afghanistan or goes over Pakistan and destroys human beings, those are assassinations. Beneath those drones, those are assassinations carried out by the United States government. Those happen every day, and each one of them can be traced directly back to the failure to turn in the direction that Kennedy was trying to turn in the fall of 1963. But there have been some more high-level people that I would put under very suspicious situations that we would have to investigate much more carefully.
Right, we don't have time to
say so-and-so got assassinated.
Right, we don't have time. We get you back on the show and we talk about Mahatma Gandhi on that then. But my last question is, what does it say about a democracy? That if your theory, conspiracy theory, is correct, what does it say about American democracy?
It says that we've got a bunch of props on a stage, and people carry out a play, and we call it democracy.
And you write that we have reason for hope and reason to worry.
We have reasons for hope because, for example, if Kennedy had not had the courage to turn in the Cuban Missile Crisis, you and I wouldn't be talking about this right now. We'd be in the middle of a nuclear wasteland, and we wouldn't be alive. And that is a reason for hope. If he had that kind of courage, we can have that kind of courage, like the people who are out occupying Wall Street or occupying Birmingham down the street from where I am right now. This is the kind of courage we need globally in order to turn this process around. Kennedy had the courage to take the hit in order to resist his government and refuse to do what would have resulted in a critical hit for the entire world. We got to have the same kind of courage, and if we have that kind of courage, there's a lot of hope.
So in other words, in the coins and currency that we have in the United States, in God we trust, we really can't trust in God. We can't trust in a government. Correct?
We can't trust in our government, but we can trust in what Gandhi called truth force, love force, soul force, which is a much more powerful force than anything that killed Kennedy. And the reason I explored Gandhi's assassination is because he was committed to that force. And the same kind of conspiracy was used in India, to my huge surprise, to kill him because he was moving in that kind of direction in a way that could have transformed the entire world. And Kennedy, without explicitly referring to Gandhi, was moving in the same direction from a position that wasn't explicitly nonviolence, but was a profound turning away from the Cold War that he had committed to himself to previously. And those are both great sources of
hope. And we'll discuss Mahatma Gandhi. We'll get you on a show for your future books. It's such a fascinating subject. Thank you for being on the show, Jim.
Well, I love talking to you guys. You're great.
Well, we
you're great questioners.
Thank you. So are you. This is fascinating. I wish we had another couple hours.
Well, let's go to it.
Okay. Thank you. Then we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Ron.
Okay. Thanks a lot,
Will.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, Ronnie. What an eye-opener that was. Thanks again, our special guest, Mr. James Douglas. We're privileged to have him on our program. Hey, Ronnie, what did you learn about our interview tonight?
It's a plausible theory. I mean, the book, if you read the book, it's incredible. I mean, it's footnoted, it's logical, it's easy to follow, and it's compelling. And there are a lot of theories out there, and nobody really accepts the Warren Commission unless they got a vested interest in it. So, you know, it's very possible that something like this happened. How about you, Willie?
Well, I think his candor was really, really right on.
Right.
I learned that Mr. Douglas has made the strongest case to date that this assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy was in fact a unadulterated coup d'etat. It's disturbing and alarming to think that the military-industrial complex, you know, heads of the intelligence agencies and the Pentagon, were the forces behind this killing. You know, this thing is going to reverberate for 1,000 years. 1,000 years, man. Hey, now, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our Crime Beat History segment of the month. Dateline, November the 17th, 1939. To punish protests against Nazi occupation of the Czech homeland, the Nazis murder 9 Czech graduate students and send over 1,200 to concentration camps and close all Czech universities and colleges. The 17th of November, that's today, is the International Students' Day, an international observance of student activism. The day commemorates the anniversary of the 1939 storming of the University of Prague after demonstrations against the killing of Jan Opatil and the occupation of Czechoslovakia, and the execution of 9 student leaders. On this day, Crime Beat honors all the students throughout the world, marking this very important day for student activism. Any comments, Ronnie?
Yes, and we're seeing more student activism. If you're watching the Occupy Wall Street, I think we're going to see another wave of activism very similar to the 60s.
Absolutely. Now, just a reminder for all your listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for November the 24th, where we'll have Ohio Police Chief Rick Perrello, the top cop turned author, wrote a riveting book titled To Kill an Irishman. Perrello chronicles the true story of Danny Green, a fearless mobster who took on the Cleveland Mafia in the 70s. Last spring, his book came out into a movie to rave reviews. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss that one. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Shepsick and yours truly, Will Harib. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. We'd like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. And in the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. If you want to support the broadcast, please make a contribution to Crime Beat via the Artist First World Radio Network. The address is on the top page of the website for quick reference. And until next week, and on behalf of Ronnie Chepsick and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune in to Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.